So the biggest red flag for you, if you're trying to keep your brain healthy and calm down brain inflammation, especially at risk for Alzheimer's, is to make sure that if you're getting fatigued after you eat and really, really tired, which by the way is not normal, you have some insulin surges, and that's going to create some devastating physiological shifts in your brain, which are not healthy.
Hi everyone, Drew Prode here. Today we're talking with my friend, Dr. Datis Kharazian, all on brain inflammation, also known as neuroinflammation. What causes it and why does it happen? And why is neuroinflammation linked to things like brain fog and even other chronic diseases like Alzheimer's and cognitive decline? Stay tuned for a fascinating conversation. Hi, everyone. I know I'm not the only one who finds sleep a little tougher in the summer. Most people don't realize that temperature has a huge impact on how well we all sleep. One study, get this, found that of 765,000 people, it found that most people have abnormal sleeping patterns during the hotter summer months because it's difficult to keep an optimal temperature in their bedroom. And the other studies showed that we sleep deeper at cooler temperatures. While I try to keep a comfortable sleep environment all year long, now that summer's here, I'm extra mindful about keeping it cool. This goes way beyond cranking up the AC. It's important to keep your bed and body from overheating to truly optimize your sleep. I tried some of the bamboo sheets from Cozy Earth, which are natural temperature regulating, and I love how cool and comfortable they keep my bed. Most people have no clue that cotton is not the ideal option for temperature regulation. It was actually used as insulation back in the early 1900s and has been used for bedding even longer. It became a commonplace even though there are much better alternatives like bamboo. With bamboo sheets from Cozy Earth, my bed stays just the right temperature, even when it's hot here in LA or wherever it is that you live. Plus, they use a special weave that makes them softer than any other brands I've tried. I also love that I can trust Cozy Earth because their entire line is free from harmful chemicals that are found in most traditional beddings. Right now, Cozy Earth is offering my audience 40% off site-wide. This is the best discount they offer anywhere. Just head over to CozyEarth.com and use the discount code Drew, spelled differently, D-H-R-U, 40, Drew 40. That's Cozy, C-O-Z-Y, Earth, EARTH.com, and use the code DHRU40. I definitely recommend checking out their super comfortable bamboo sheets so you can get better sleep today. So when I was younger, I used to snack on a lot of processed foods, sugary snacks to keep me fueled for sports and school. And I remember feeling I'd have this huge sugar rush followed by a major crash. I'd pass out on the couch for hours, totally exhausted. And by the way, I and everybody around me thought this was completely normal. So here's the thing. Most snacks on the market, even the ones labeled natural or gluten-free, are so carb and sugar heavy that they spike your blood sugar and leave you feeling like crap. That's why we've done so many episodes on blood sugar. The key is to find a snack that has the right combination of protein and fats to keep you energized without spikes in your blood sugar. That's the name of the game for balanced energy. So I feel super fortunate that I finally found the best snacks from a company called Paleo Valley that hit my protein and fat needs. I love, love, love taking their products with me when I'm traveling or I'm out for the day shooting podcast. They completely nailed it with both high quality ingredients and really amazing taste and texture. My personal favorites are the pasture raised turkey sticks and the superfood bars. I love the pasture raised turkey sticks because they're made from truly pasture-raised turkeys, which by the way is incredibly hard to find. The turkeys are given full access to the outdoors and graze on pesticide-free pasture. Pasture-raised is way better than traditional, by the way. They're not fed corn and a bunch of other junk. They're actually fed what they normally eat in nature. I also love Paleo Valley's superfood bars because they're gluten, grain, soy, and added sugar-free, and they have 100% bone broth protein. My favorite flavor is dark chocolate chip. Who doesn't love chocolate chip? If you're on the hunt for better snacks for you and your family, you should definitely check out Paleo Valley. Right now, they're offering my listeners 15% off their entire first order. Just go to paleovalley.com/Drew That's paleo, yes, like Paleolithic, paleovalley.com/Drew, D-H-R-U, to check out all their clean paleo protein products and take advantage of this deal today. Paleovalley.com/Drew. It's in the show notes as well. Check out this fantastic deal today. Welcome to the Drew Perowit Podcast. Each week, we explore the inner workings of the brain and the body with one of the brightest minds in wellness, medicine, and mindset. This week's guest is Dr. Datis Karazian. Dr. Karazian is a clinical researcher, scientist, academic professor, and functional medicine healthcare provider. He's an associate clinical professor at Loma Linda University's School of Medicine and a research fellow at Harvard Medical School and a researcher at the Department of Neurology at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Karazian earned a PhD degree in health science with concentrations in immunology and toxicology, and a Doctor of Health Science degree from Nova Southeastern University. He completed his postdoctoral research training at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Karazian earned a Master of Science degree in human nutrition from the University of Bridgeport, a Doctor of Chiropractic degree from Southern California University of Health Sciences, and a Master's of Medical Sciences degree in clinical investigation from Harvard Medical School. He is the guy when it comes to things like autoimmune and researching brain inflammation. And on today's podcast, we're going to be talking about those subjects, and in particular, neuroinflammation, which is inflammation of the brain, which is linked to all sorts of different conditions, from low-level symptoms of brain fog and memory loss to full-blown symptoms of Alzheimer's and cognitive decline. Dr. Datis Karazian, thank you for joining the podcast. It's an honor to have you here.
Thank you, Drew, for having me.
There was a big article this past week in the New York Times talking about the link between diabetes and pre-diabetes and Alzheimer's. Now, in our world, there's been this terminology that's been thrown out for a while in the world of functional medicine. For the courses that you teach for end consumers and practitioners, you've been talking about it, and it's type 3 diabetes. So let's just jump right in and talk about, what is the connection between diabetes, pre-diabetes, and Alzheimer's, and how does that fit into the context of this term neuroinflammation?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the term type 3 diabetes came from some scientific papers a couple authors published, and that was thrown around there, but it makes a lot of sense because there's such a link to it. So basically, when people have diabetes or pre-diabetes, you know, it's really about an insulin surge. And if you're a person listening, your biggest clue that you're having insulin surges is if you get really tired after you eat. So if you eat a meal and you just need to crash and have coffee afterwards, that's a big sign that you're getting an insulin surge. And what insulin, when you have those insulin surges all the time, it gets very hard for your energy from your food, which is basically glucose, to get into your cells. And then your body pumps out more and more insulin. But this insulin your body releases to get, you know, glucose from your food into your cells for energy has some really devastating effects on the brain. And one of the things that it does is it activates cells in the brain called neuroglia that then create inflammation. So it's basically stimulating the inflammatory cells in the brain to become active. And it also has an impact on something called amyloid precursor protein, which really is involved with setting up the structure for these tangles and plaques people get in Alzheimer's disease. So one of the biggest drivers of Alzheimer's disease is clearly being shown from a lifestyle perspective to be these insulin surges. So if you have pre-diabetes or diabetes, it's definitely there. But a lot of people don't know they have insulin resistance. So like when we work up a new patient or we evaluate someone, we get their blood work back, you know, their glucose is above 100. So the biggest red flag for you if you're trying to keep your brain healthy and calm down brain inflammation, especially the risk for Alzheimer's, is to make sure that if you're getting fatigued after you eat and really, really tired, which by the way is not normal, you have some insulin surges, and that's going to create some devastating physiological shifts in your brain, which are not healthy.
I've also heard, I'd love to get your thoughts on this, and obviously everybody varies genetically, but the idea that as you get older, the more belly fat and sort of like the hip to waist ratio can be also a good indication as like an early sign that maybe there's more insulin being produced in the body than is needed. And our body's doing exactly what it's designed to do, which is it's an energy storage mechanism. So it's storing that energy for later use. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, there's actually a paper and a few papers that call it the adipocyte neuroglia axis, which is the fat cells and the connection between the fat cells and the immune inflammatory cells in the brain. And, you know, when we have insulin resistance and we eat meals and we can't get that fuel into our cells for energy, that fuel, that extra glucose that goes into fat storage. And then fat cells have really been identified now as an endocrine gland. So before we used to just think of body fat as, you know, storage of extra calories, but fat cells are now classified as an endocrine gland because adipocytes create hormones and proteins. And they release things like leptin, and they release these inflammatory proteins called cytokines. And these different compounds impact and communicate with cells in the brain. So the more body fat you have, and the more your body fat is activated with insulin, like sugar and carbohydrates and things like that, that turns on these adipocytes, these fat cells, to then activate inflammation in the brain. So it's this very fascinating physiological mechanism.
So let's take a step back. I mean, you are known for talking about a lot of different topics. In fact, you teach practitioners about a lot of these new studies, trends, and best ways to apply them for patients who have honestly been seeing maybe a lot of doctors and not getting better. So I think it's a great opportunity to have the teacher himself explain things on a level that the students can get a chance to understand. So I want to do a 101 and maybe even a 202 on neuroinflammation. So let's start at the beginning. Break down just that word, neuroinflammation, and help us understand what are the primary drivers today in our modern day society that is causing this neuroinflammation in the body.
Okay, sure. So when you look at the brain, or look at any tissue, there's cells in there. And with the brain as a tissue, there's two types of cells in the brain. One are called neurons, which everyone's familiar with, which causes synapses and allows you to think and have emotions and all the things you probably know what the brain does. But the other cell in the brain is called the neuroglia. And glia is a Latin term for glue. And they thought the initial function of these cells was just to glue the neurons together, but it's actually found to be very, very metabolically active. So there's different types of neuroglia. But the point is that these neuroglia cells are in our brain. And one of their main jobs is to get rid of debris. So as we get older and as our normal neurons start to die off, they have to be cleaned up. That debris and those dead cells meant to be cleaned up. So the neuroglia normally go in there and they clean that debris up. And then also just from normal physiological function of the brain, we get some proteins that stick around for a while. These are things like alpha-synuclein, beta-amyloid, and then the glia clears those up. What happens in neurodegenerative diseases is this cleaning up process doesn't take place. And this cleaning up process is known as autophagy or mitophagy. They're just how the brain cleans up debris. And in what happens in neurodegenerative diseases is these inflammatory reactions lose their ability to clear out these proteins, and they actually shift in creating inflammation in the brain where it helps promote more of these proteins. So it does like the opposite thing. So when you look at every single neurodegenerative disease or you look at head trauma, you know, when those things impact the brain, it's really through these neuroglial cells. They're actually injuring neurons in the area, and they are leading to inability to get rid of these debris. So what triggers that? That's the question, the second part of your question. So they're triggered by brain injury. They're triggered by air pollution. Lots of studies now linking air pollution in different communities to dementia, Alzheimer's disease. This is the pulmonary neuroglia axis. We already talked about adipocyte glial axis. There's the microbiome neuroglia axis, where the things we eat, the food, that things that are inflammatory in our gut can turn on these neuroglial cells. There's the pulmonary barrier neuroglia axis, where infections and things we have in our lungs can turn on these glial cells in the brain. And any part of our immune system that gets activated, for whatever the mechanisms may be, can also turn on these inflammatory reactions in the brain. And the problem with that is the brain doesn't have a healthy anti-inflammatory antioxidant system. So there's very little antioxidants in the brain. And when this inflammatory process turns on in the brain, it really causes loss of function. And in the early stages, so, you know, when you look at brain inflammation, neuroinflammation, and neurodegenerative disease, it doesn't just go from you have the disease and you don't have the disease. It goes through stages. So the very first stage of brain inflammation is brain fatigue, brain endurance issues. So people just start to notice when these pathways turn on is they can't read like they used to read as much as they used to. Is they, you know, they maybe used to sat down and read 10 chapters or an hour, and now they can barely get through one. They can't drive as long as they used to. Driving really is taxing for them. They have to take breaks. Everything they do just that's cognitive, it requires their brain, just doesn't have as much endurance. So that's the first sign. And then it goes into
which by the way, if I could interrupt for a second, sure. A lot of people attribute to just old age. Hey, I'm getting older. I can't focus as much, or I can't see as well when I'm driving or drive as long. But what you're really talking about is that, sure, this might be increasing over a period of time, but is it the age or is it the inflammation that's the driver behind this?
Exactly. So we're all going to lose some degree of cell function as we get older, but you should be able to read, you should be able to drive, you should be able to do things you were doing within a reasonable amount of time. And, you know, when we get older, there's also the possibility for neuroplasticity, where our neuron connections get much more efficient and much faster, and we're able to engage in things much more efficiently. So it really goes in the balance. Now, most people in the population have more neuroinflammation, neuroplasticity over time, so they just notice their brain function goes down. But then there's others that their neuroplasticity, their neurons connecting together and staying healthy are working at a higher degree than their brain inflammation. So as they get, you know, older and older, their brain function improves. Like, I can tell you my brain function now at almost 50 is much, much, much better than it was when I was 20. Just because of connectivity, plasticity, using my brain, you know, doing all the things I do with it from my cognitive tasks are completely different. And hopefully in the next 10 years, I can keep my neuroinflammation down and keep my neuroplasticity up, so I can maintain high level of function as my career matures, you know. And as a healthcare provider, as an educator, as a researcher, you know, you got to save your brain. Same thing with many professions.
So you were mentioning earlier some of the signs that somebody's brain might literally be on the fire from the inside out, right? That's what we're really talking about, is neuroinflammation is basically, it's a version of your brain and your body being on fire, and that causing all this debris, which we'll come back to in a minute. So one sign is you can't focus for as long as you used to. You can't read anymore. You feel very sort of distracted or agitated. You can't maintain that. Another example is you gave, you may not be able to drive for long periods of time. What are some other, whether they're things that people notice or whether they're diagnosable conditions that are linked and connected to neuroinflammation?
Okay, great. So as far as diagnosable conditions, I mean, a general one is like general fatigue syndrome. Like, so when the brain is fatigued, the whole body is fatigued, right? So one of the things that sometimes people get diagnosed with chronic fatigue, you know, as an example. And as a clinician, I always ask the question, what are the things that cause your fatigue? And they say, if they say things like, well, driving causes, when you really break it down with them, and driving and doing cognitive tasks really causes fatigue. And they might say, you know, on the weekends, it's not so bad, but on the weekends, I'm not on my computer all day at work. I'm not engaging with people. I'm just getting a chance to rest. That's a big sign that that their chronic fatigue is really, you know, early neuroinflammation, neurodegeneration. And another common diagnosis that takes place with neuroinflammation is just depression. So in the world of psychiatry, you know, and neurology, the focus for many years was on a neurotransmitter problem. So like your serotonin was low, your dopamine is low, and then you would take like a serotonin reuptake inhibitor or another kind of neurotransmitter stimulating medication. But now there's a huge trend in the research, which is really focused on, and I think the next level, which is the cytokine model of depression, or the inflammatory model of depression. So when there's a lot of inflammation in the brain, nerve conductance or nerve speed slows down. And when that happens in areas of the brain called the cingulate gyrus, prefrontal cortex, people get depressed. So,
whereas previously the understanding and sort of the model of depression, can you contrast thus to sort of what people understood in the medical world of what they thought was driving depression?
Yeah, well, what they thought was driving depression was like your serotonin was low, and you take something called like serotonin reuptake inhibitor, and that would slow down your serotonin breakdown. The interesting thing is when they've looked at those medications have an initial anti-inflammatory effect, and then it stops having that effect. The immune system then takes over, and the neuroglia don't adapt to that drug anymore for anti-inflammatory effect. And this is also what you see the clinical outcomes. When you look at someone taking a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, they notice that they have a honeymoon phase where that's great and it works well for them. And then as they take it longer, it doesn't. And part of the reason may be that it had nothing to do with the neurotransmitter itself, that it really was dampening the inflammatory response. And really their major cause of depression is brain inflammation. And then the brain inflammation may be linked to, like you said, insulin and diabetes or air pollution or the microbiome, or really a combination of all these factors that's now shutting down their nerve speed because of the inflammation in the brain.
So let's continue down the pathway. And actually, the one that you talked about, air pollution, is really interesting because right now, I mean, if you Google top 50 most polluted cities in the world, where I'm from in India, where I'm from, which is India, I was actually born in Kenya, but where I'm from originally, ancestry is India. India has I think it's 11 of the top 50 most polluted cities. China has probably the rest, and then there's a few others sprinkled out throughout the world. What is this massive air pollution, which is not just a problem in India and China, it's becoming a problem here in the US as well and other places. What is that doing to our brain health?
Absolutely. I'll talk about, yeah, for sure. But let me just point out one other thing. Your air pollution can also be in your home. Like if you have really old carpet and you have your vents have never been clean, like the air quality in your home you live in every single day could be really, really poor, even though you maybe live in an area where it's not the top air pollution city, like, I don't know, like in India or China or Los Angeles or something. But but the key thing is, so that's something to be aware of too. Now, what happens with air pollution is very fascinating. There's two known mechanisms published on this. One of them is it activates your pulmonary immune system. Your lung has a barrier system, just like your gut. And there's cells there called dendritic cells and macrophages. And then once those chemicals come in, they activate them. And that creates an inflammatory response. And those inflammatory messengers from the lung immune system turn on neuroglial cells in the brain. Another mechanism is directly through our nasal passage pathways that our nerve sensors, our olfactory nerve, connect with our olfactory bulb and have direct connections into the brain. So when our smell receptors get exposed to these pollutants, that drives the inflammatory chemical response all the way through our smell pathways into our brain. And these smell pathways, by the way, really go to an area of the brain called the hippocampus, which is the first site of Alzheimer's disease degeneration. And there are numerous studies now called epidemiological type research where they find direct findings of MRI degeneration correlated with air pollution, like scary levels of statistical association. And so we're probably getting some inflammation activating directly through neurons, through our nasal passages into our brain, and also through our lung respiratory pathways. But the air we breathe is really, really impactful. And also looking at apps now that can measure the amount of particulate, small pollutants in the air. And they've also published studies where they can look at the air quality of those days and see different, they can do cognitive tests with people and it changes. And they've also published studies where they take office buildings, improve ventilation, so these particulate matters aren't around, and the work performance changes. So it's like immediate, has an immediate impact on brain. So it's pretty fascinating stuff.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because we tend to think of cities being polluted, but I believe it was in the mid 80s, the EPA did a study. We'll link to it in the show notes. I don't have the exact year. They found that indoor air quality could be up to 300 times more polluted and more particulates than outdoor air quality. And it's just another great reminder that there's so many things inside the home, whether that be, as you mentioned, carpet, air vents, could be mold toxicity that people have floating around inside of their home and sort of, these byproducts that mold put out there, these cytokines that trigger a cytokine response. So there's so many things even inside of our home. So let me just ask you, since we're on this topic, what do you do? What does the doctor himself do to try to maintain a healthier indoor air quality?
So there's a few things that I've done in my home to ensure that we have the best air quality. First of all, you have to get a good home air filter, like an air filter. Like, and it has to be a HEPA filter, H-E-P-A. Those are the only ones that really work. Studies have clearly shown that they get rid of these small particles and they can even get rid of mycotoxins, things in your air. And then different size HEPA filters account for different types of square footage. So you might have more than one in each of your rooms. Like right now, I have a HEPA filter here, and I have one in every room of my home, and I have it in every room of my office, and it's just on. It's pretty silent. You can't hear it. And that's one way that clearly has been published in research to make a difference. I don't use carpet in my home. Carpet is just I just put everything wooden floors in my home. I try to make my home not just free of air pollution, but chemicals. So I use just natural wood, oil, polish, none of the chemicals in there. So I don't have that offload from formaldehydes and dust particles to stay in there. And then,
which is really interesting, because if I could just interrupt for a second, is that, you know, you come from a Iranian Persian background and I come from an Indian background. And, you know, whenever I visit, you know, India, or I have a lot of Persian friends, my fiance is Persian, they would always talk about how the homes in Iran or the homes in India, there's no carpet. Like, carpet is very much like an American thing. They would always have either concrete or sort of wood. And that's just one way of keeping the home cleaner. And by the way, on top of that, you're not wearing shoes inside of the house, which are going to bring in all these sorts of different particulates and also increase the pollution that's there.
Yeah. And then your air vents in your home are very important. But also, one of the most profound things published is really your circulation within your home, having actually healthy airflow through your home. So, and by the way, if you're like work, if you're sleeping in your room and your carpet is just giving a lot of offload, you don't even have toxic mold. You said toxic mold, but even just if you have mildew, which isn't necessarily toxic mold, mildew is an air pollutant. It creates particles that can impact your health and breathing. So you have mildew, you have, you know, like stuff from carpet, you don't have good circulation in the air. Those things can really impact your brain and your lung brain access connection, especially if you're sleeping in your room every day for hours, or if you're working in your office every day for hours. So those are the things that we start with, because you can't change like the amount of air pollution in the city you live in too much. You have to, you know, you really, when things become clinical, it's like, what can we really do to impact a person's health right away? So we can't change air quality in the city they live in, but we can definitely change air quality in their home and in their bedroom. So we start with their, as a clinician, I always start with their bedroom and the office setting they're in, wherever they're working in the most, and try to get those areas cleaned up.
Yeah, there's a great TED talk about how plants and certain types of plants can be brought into the home. We'll link to in the show notes. That is a low-cost solution. Another low-cost solution for those that are in a place where maybe finances are tight, just like you said, air circulation, which often could be just opening the windows as much as you possibly can, getting that air to turn around. You know, not everybody can afford a filter. I'm lucky that I can. You obviously, you know, can too, but not everybody's in that situation. So just even opening the windows is sometimes enough to just get fresh air in and not have that stagnant air continuing to pollute your lungs, your body, and ultimately your brain.
Yep. And again, studies clearly show the amount of circulation airflow you have an immediate effect on cognitive function.
It's true. So. It's true. There's in our offices, although nobody's working from the office anymore, we use a device. I'm not affiliated with them in any way, but it's called Aware, AWAIR. And the interesting thing that they do is that they give you alerts and they say, you know, the particulate count is going up. The chemical count is going up. It's going to be hard for you to focus. Please ventilate immediately. Like you get these alerts on your phone and it's just another reminder of like, this is real, you know? And this is why sometimes people say, I just don't feel that they may not equate it to, I don't feel inspired right now. I feel stuffy. I feel this, I feel that. It could sometimes be your environment and you just need to mix that environment up a little bit, maybe get in some fresh air. So let's pivot from air quality to other areas that are severely driving neuroinflammation. When you work with your patients, you talk with these clinicians and you're helping them understand the driving factors of neuroinflammation, after you touch on air, what's one of the next things you look at?
Well, the other one we've already mentioned is insulin. So blood sugar spikes is a major trigger for brain inflammation. So, you know, as you know, one of the questions I always ask patients and teach practitioners to do is ask the question, how do you feel, how does your energy after you eat a meal? So a normal response should be, there's no change in energy after you eat a meal. You just aren't hungry anymore. So there's really two abnormal responses. One is, I feel a lot better when I eat. I can function again. I can think again. I can focus again. So that's a sign that the person's hypoglycemic. And low blood glucose also has an unhealthy effect on the brain. As a matter of fact, the symptoms that people have when their blood sugar drops is they can't think. They can't focus. They can't concentrate. They get blurry vision because their pupillary constrictor dilator neurological function is off. They even get tremors. They get shaky. I mean, it's like the brain isn't getting fuel. And that has long-term effects promoting neurodegeneration. So we look for that. And then we also look at insulin surges, like getting really tired after you eat, having to take a nap and craving sugar, and then having to have a Starbucks run or a coffee run after you eat or something like that. Those are all insulin surges. So those spikes in blood sugar, whether it's low or high, besides air pollution, air quality is another major factor on turning on neurodegenerative neuroinflammatory pathways in the brain.
So, and question for you on that.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you do? Do you personally use like a continuous glucose monitor, or have you found certain types of foods? Because even a lot of healthy foods, quote unquote, can be foods, especially in the gluten-free category, that can really cause a lot of these insulin spikes. And people sometimes think, I'm eating really healthy. I'm eating this thing that's gluten-free or cassava or this or that or whatever. And they don't realize that that thing is sort of putting them on this roller coaster ride of glucose throughout the day.
Well, certainly, a continuous glucose monitor would be ideal. But in a real setting, like in for most people, because of restriction of getting that and cost, is just simply looking at your energy levels, how you feel is good. It's a very good clinical way to look at it, and it directly relates to the patient's experience. So usually, for example, if people get shaky, lightheaded, eat, and then feel better, they'll have to basically learn to eat sooner than later. Because what happens when they become severely hypoglycemic is they also lose their appetite regulation centers. And then they start to train themselves like, oh, I know it's time to eat when my screen gets blurry. I know it's time to eat when I get agitated. And it's like, no, your blood sugar's already dropped. You've already turned off these adverse pathways. You want to stop doing that. So then for them, they would just go back and try to maybe even set their phone alarm to go off like an hour before they usually notice their drop or something, and they eat something, and preferably something with healthy fats. Like olive oil or avocados, or if they can handle nuts, or something with really good in fiber, like a high fiber or high healthy fat snack will really help make sure the blood sugar doesn't drop as much. Versus like in a lot of hypoglycemics, they'll have like a gluten-free muffin and a coffee or something with the meal, and it's not even a real coffee. It's with like whipped cream and all the other stuff. And they don't realize that that's going to cause that roller coaster, right? And then for insulin resistance people, they basically have to do either one of two things: either cut down the amount of carbohydrates if they're still getting tired after they're eating, or cut down on the portion size. And then the more physical activity they do, the greater tolerance they have for portion size and the amount of carbs they eat. So some have to go extreme and get into ketosis to stop those blood sugar spikes. Some people can just limit the carb intake. But at some point, like when I work with patients and we teach practitioners, we tell them, your patient that is suffering from depression or chronic fatigue that may be related to neuroinflammation, they have to get to the point that they do not have energy fluctuations, better or worse, after they eat. Until you get that under control, you're not going to get rid of a very important driving mechanism of neuroinflammation. And it's not even supplement related. You got to get that under control.
Yeah, sometimes you want to talk about the latest supplement or the latest advancement that's out there. And first, it's like, let's get metabolically healthy, which means let's get our glucose under control so we're not on this roller coaster, and then see all the things that are left after we solve that. And I'm sure you've seen patients who see an improvement in their health just addressing that aspect.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the patients I see, and a lot of people see that practice preventive medicine, functional medicine, is the person coming in with bags and bags full of supplements, right? So they're taking everything. And you're like, well, why don't you stop taking anything new and just get your blood sugar stable? And stop being hypoglycemic, or figure out how to get your insulin surge under control. And I can tell you, a lot of times in my practice, we haven't recommended supplements for months and months and months. And we're just trying to get these things under control. Like we said, dramatically impacting brain function by improving air quality, air function, circulation in the room, in their home, and then keeping their blood sugar stable. You want to change your brain fog? Those two things will be profound, more so than any supplement you can possibly take.
Now, there's another category, and you talked about it earlier, and you talked about these glial cells in the brain. And in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of advancements in really helping people understand the core question of, for a long time, scientists didn't really know, like, why do we really sleep? And then there was a understanding that, well, at night, these glial cells are really active, and that's when they're doing most of their work, which you shared earlier. We have a bunch of dump trucks that are driving around our brain at night and are taking the trash out of the streets, cleaning up the highways so that we can function again properly the next day. So let's talk about the importance of sleep when it comes to neuroinflammation.
Yeah, so there's a few things that really positively impact these neuroglial cells to get rid of debris, right? And if you really look at neurons fire from one into the other, and then they stay healthy. And then if you have debris in between them, then those neurons don't fire into each other. And then if these neurons don't get stimulated, they start to atrophy. So when you look at Alzheimer's, for example, there's all this protein debris of amyloid plaque in there, and these neurons can't synapse into each other, and then they start to atrophy. Just like if you had a muscle you stopped using, it was in a cast, they start to atrophy. That's what's happening when all this debris is there. And these neuroglial cells get rid of it. So these neuroglial cells are profoundly impacted in their function by sleep. So that's like you brought up. Also by exercise. Exercise like activates these glial cells to be much, much more efficient. And also an anti-inflammatory diet has an effect on these glial cells, and eating high amounts of flavonoids tend to have a very powerful impact on these glial cells. So foods with lots of different colors that are rich in antioxidants and various flavonoids tend to really make a difference for these. So if you're getting plenty of sleep, some exercise, and a diet rich of flavonoids, you're doing, you know, really key essential things to get these neuroglial cells. On the other hand, if you're not sleeping very well and your food has no color, it's pretty much bland, right? And you're sedentary, then you're churning on all these mechanisms to not have your body's ability to clear debris out of your brain. And over a period of time, it's really going to promote Alzheimer's disease and neurodegeneration.
Sleep is one of those challenging categories, because if you walk up to most people on the street and you kind of go up to them in any random city in Times Square, wherever, and you say, hey, do you eat healthy? Most people will respond back, yeah, I eat pretty healthy, because everybody has a different definition of what healthy means to them. Maybe healthy is smoking only one pack of cigarettes a day instead of two pack of cigarettes a day, right? Everybody has a different definition. And sleep is very similar. You talk to most people and you say, how do you sleep? And people say, yeah, you know, I try my best. I get a good amount of sleep. What do you find? What is good sleep in your definition, having worked with a lot of patients? And what are the most common disruptors to quality of sleep that people end up getting?
Okay. So, I mean, there's case specific and there's general. Let's talk about general first. So first of all, what's good sleep? Good sleep is your body's ability to wake up when it just feels like it's had enough sleep. So it's not an alarm waking you up. Like when you start to wake up before your alarm and you feel rested, that's probably a person who's had good sleep. Okay. And very simple. You should feel like you've recovered when you've woken up and you're ready to go. If you feel like you just can't get up, that's a sign you're not getting good quality sleep. The other key thing is being able to sleep for an extended period of time. So like if your person's up two or three times a day to go to use the bathroom, or they wake up in the middle of the night with anxiety and palpitations, those are all things that are a problem. So it's just continuous sleep, because you want these different cycles of REM to engage to really have the best effects on neuroglia and other cells. They have to go into these different stages of sleep cycles to really turn on and make those machineries happen that are important for our brain protection. So continuous sleep and then feeling rested when you wake up with the big signs. Now, what are the most common things that cause sleep problems? One of them is hypoglycemia. Like people who wake up in the middle of the night, their blood sugar levels drop, and it's called nocturnal hypoglycemia. So a typical person that has low blood sugar as a cause of their insomnia will usually wake up around 3 to 4 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes they have anxiety, sometimes palpitations, but that's very, very common. And what people have to understand is like when you eat, you're eating foods for energy, but you're also storing a lot of your glucose from your food as glycogen in the liver. And then when you're asleep, your body has to use this stored glucose called glycogen to feed your brain, since you're not eating anything for extended periods of time. But if you're hypoglycemic and missing meals all the time and having simple sugars, you don't build enough glycogen. So by the time you get into like 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, there's no glycogen there. Your adrenal glands release epinephrine to break down protein and fat for energy for your brain. And then that makes you wake up. So one of the first things is, and that person will be the one who eats a meal and feels better, like they can focus and concentrate. That's your typical hypoglycemic. So those patients that have those hypoglycemic tends to also have insomnia, especially being able to stay asleep. Another one is just hypoxia to the brain. Like a lot of people don't get healthy oxygen to the brain. They get palate paresis, where the palate impacts the back of their tongue, the respiratory pathways. Poor brain function in general actually leads to sleep problems, because it impacts the pathways of the pneumotaxis centers that are involved with brain sleep. So it does become a vicious cycle. Lots of men as they get older too have like prostate issues. A lot of females have overactive bladders. Those mechanisms really impact their sleep. And that's like the general. And then you have case specific, and that's the whole series of bag. And those are people who have impacted their inability for what they call their frontostriatal projections to dampen their reticular formation. And that can be different from one person to the next.
Let's talk about the breathing component. Yeah. We've done a whole bunch of podcasts on breathing. We've done one with James. What's that?
Breathe through your nose.
Yeah, breathe through your nose, potentially use mouth taping, as a vehicle. Some cases, people getting, you know, their tongue tie released through a simple operation. And then in other cases where people have full-blown, a lot of people who have sleep apnea don't even know that they have it because they're not the classic candidate, you know, typically an overweight, older, you know, male or, you know, overweight male. And they have sleep apnea because of some challenges. So for any time you see a patient, you might suspect that something's going on. Is your first recommendation like, hey, you got to go get a sleep study? Like, how do you navigate that side of things?
Well, definitely a sleep study is always a good idea with anyone who's got fatigue and doesn't feel rested in the morning. So right off the bat, if you don't feel rested in the morning, you should probably go get a sleep study because it's more prevalent than you may think. And you may actually have issues and not know it. If you can't, if you just want a really cheap sleep study, get a pulse ox for like $20 off Amazon, have your spouse put it on your finger in the middle of the night and see what your oxygen levels are. And if you're, you know, in that below 95%, you're not getting oxygen to your tissues, you're not breathing. And then you're not going to oxygenate your brain. So simple pulse ox, having a spouse put it on your finger in the middle of the night, checking that a couple times. And if it's low, you know, below 95%, you know, you may definitely want to get a sleep study and oxygen may be impacting your brain. So I'll usually only use sleep studies because, you know, they're not fun for anyone to do. Most common, like chief complaint is I don't feel rested when I first wake up in the morning. That's always the biggest clue for me. That's the opposite of what should happen.
Yeah, I know there's some new technology that's coming out and some at-home sleep studies. I don't know if you've encountered any of them, but it still seems like it's emerging and the cost is kind of coming down. But if you ever come across anything interesting, please send it to us so we can recommend it to our listeners.
Yeah, likewise. If you know, you seem to know about all these new things coming out, so tell me too.
Let's go back to you mentioned the hypoglycemic component. So what's something that you do besides, you know, folks starting to now have more regular meal timings, which is especially important. You know, we've done a few episodes on the topic of especially women in the childbearing years being very careful about fasting regularly and being more mindful about you know, they might do time restricted eating, but maybe fasting the way that men do and missing and skipping breakfast, maybe that's not always a good idea for everybody, especially women in the child, you know, bearing age range, which is, you know, going to be most women that are listening to this podcast. Yeah. So when you are starting to help somebody improve their sleep that is having this sort of anxiety driven effect where they wake up in the middle of the night and they sort of heart palpitations or they feel anxious for some sort of reason. Is there a simple hack that you start to bring in to help squash that a little bit? Is there anything you have them eating or doing at night in addition to trying to meet those regular meal times?
Sure. So the biggest problem is you have to start from the very first morning part of the day, like in the morning when they wake up, first part of the day when they wake up. So that's where it all starts. So it's not just like you can't take the meal, like, because you're building glycogen reserves all throughout the day. So if you're trying to really stop someone from having this hypoglycemia event and wake up in the middle of the night, you got to start with breakfast. And I got to tell you, if you're hypoglycemic, you are not ready for intermittent fasting. You can definitely throw yourself off, make your brain function go down, and have some issues. So in order to be able to have healthy intermittent fasting, you have to have some degree of adaptation from using ketones, and your body has to be able to regulate its blood sugar to some degree so you can get into a fast without having your brain function completely go down. The people that try intermittent fasting and hate it and can't do it and crash are really ones that would probably do better going through ketosis first, getting their body fat adapted to using ketones for energy, and then they can transition to intermittent fasting. But a hypoglycemic that just tries to go into intermittent fasting is going to have some problems. And if they're trying to get rid of their sleep at night issues, they're going to have to basically wake up in the morning and have healthy amounts of fats and fibers and eat frequently enough. And the way they'll know they're going to sleep through the night is throughout the day, they haven't had those eating and then feeling like they're functioning back again. So most of the time, you know, I'll tell you a task, classical hypoglycemia. First of all, yeah, I go, do you eat healthy? They're like, yes. What do you eat? Oh, I wake up and make my own smoothie with whatever, and I had honey, I had tea with honey. And you're like, okay, all sugar, but I guess it's, you know, nutrient rich. And then what do you do for lunch? Well, sometimes I skip, sometimes I don't. Yeah, if I eat something, it'll be like in 2 o'clock, I'll have a salad. Already blood sugar dropped. They're already depleted all the glycogen that they already had. And then like, what's dinner? Dinner is like, then I might have like a cookie or a chocolate at 2 o'clock or 4 o'clock. There's always some sweet right around 2 or 4 o'clock. But again, it might be like healthy dark chocolate or I don't know, fruit yogurt or, you know, something like that, piece of fruit. And then like they have dinner, and dinner's like salad and veggies. Again, something probably really healthy. Then they get that craving right before bed for another piece of dark chocolate or something sweet. And on the surface, you know, they're getting flavonoids, and their really bad dessert is a piece of dark chocolate, and they're eating smoothies and lots of fruits, but they're not getting enough healthy fats and protein to help get enough glycogen reserve for them. So they end up falling apart that way. So they're kind of confused, because on the surface, it looks like they're eating really healthy foods, because their foods are healthy. Lots of vegetables, lots of fruits, but fortunately a lot of sugar, not enough healthy fats.
They're so basically eating dessert the whole day.
Kind of like a hummingbird, just, you know, burning off sugar all day and then missing meals and stuff like that. So what we teach them is there isn't really like a menu or diet. You just got to learn to recognize when you eat, your energy levels come back, and to eat frequently enough so you're not playing that roller coaster game. So typically what it'll mean for them is they'll like have to wake up and have some kind of protein source. And maybe they feel like nauseous if they even think about eating protein, or vegetables. And they may have to completely get off fruit for a period of time. So, you know, all your minerals and vitamins are in veggies. Fruit just adds the sugar to it. So they can go on a high vegetable, high fiber. They can have a salad with olive oil in the morning, for example, right? Or they can have sardines in the morning, or they can have something that's really high in healthy fat and protein. And then for snacks, they would eat, again, either vegetables, like let's say celery and hummus or something like that, or nut butter with their celery, you know, something that's really high quality, healthy fats and proteins, fiber. And if they did that throughout the day, not missed a meal, they probably would stop waking up in the middle of the night. So that would be that'd be one scenario to do it. And then at that point, once they get stable there, they should also notice their brain function dramatically change. And they're actually slowing down mechanisms that promote brain inflammation from drops in blood sugar spikes that will protect them in the long term for diseases like Alzheimer's.
I think an important theme that I just want to highlight here for everybody who's listening and watching is that, you know, we often think of our brain health as healthy, and then, you know, we hear stories of a loved one or an older family member that they seem so healthy, and then all of a sudden they went to the doctor's office one day and they leave with the diagnosis of Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or other stuff. What we have to understand is that these diseases don't come out of nowhere. They've been building up for years, and we don't have the scientific test at the moment to be able to catch them when they're at, let's say, you know, 75% exactly and 65%. But what we can do is we can notice the markers along the way. And what you're highlighting here is, like, if you're waking up in the morning and you're feeling tired, if you can't read anymore and you used to love to read, these are all signs that you're on the pathway, the highway to something much later on developing. We call it sometimes subclinical. It may not have a diagnosis yet, but it's well on its way to go then. Now, our hope is that you don't end up with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or some sort of other cognitive decline or worse. But if you don't want that, now is the time to intervene.
Yeah, and also even just looking at their current time, and the key thing is if you have better brain function, you're better at everything you do in your life. So if your brain function is healthy, you have great brain endurance, your ability to do all the things you love is enhanced, right? So if you're working and you want to really dominate your field, it starts with your brain function, you know? So it's like, if you have lots of brain endurance, you keep going for long periods of time, your cognitive function is high, your mental speed is high, your recall is good, that's only going to enhance everything you do. So
that's a great
really, like, where you end up with neurodegeneration down the road. And then when it progresses from there, it won't be a neurodegenerative disease. It'll be depression and then fatigue and brain fog. And then eventually it turns into disease.
That's a great point. You're not just doing it to not get disease. You're doing it so you can live a happier, healthier life and give love and attention to all the things that you care about now.
Yeah. And perform at your peak.
Well said. There's this one topic around glial cells that I just want to make sure that we really talk about in the language that you use in your courses on your website, which, by the way, are fantastic. And we have a link to them in the show notes. Anybody who wants to go deep and really get college and deeper level education on these topics there, so you can help yourself and your family, you know, please do check out these courses. You have one on brain autoimmunity, but inside of the brain one, you talk about what it really means when the glial cells are primed. So can you talk about that?
So this is the worst consequence that that can happen to your glial cells. And it happens to many of us over a period of time to different degrees. So, you know, if you look at glial, there's different types of these glia cells, right? There's microglia, there's astrocytes, oligodendrocytes. These are all different glial cells. But the ones that we're concerned about primarily are called microglia. And microglia, like, are basically, if you see videos of them in a microscope, they're walking around in your brain. They're like scavenging. They're scavengers. They move. And they have these legs that walk around and move, and they look for debris, and they clean it up, and they move around, they clean the debris. So it's almost like seeing little spiders all throughout your brain. And when you look at some of these imaging studies and studies where they do in vitro testing. So those microglial cells can develop into something what's called primed glial cells. And the best example of this to start with is like a traumatic brain injury. So, for example, if you get trauma to your brain, these glial cells become primed. What happens is they lose their legs, and they lose what are called ramifications, and they turn into an amblyoid structure, and then they stop moving, and then they shift into a state of inflammation all the time. And with these glial cells, there's something called M1 or M2 polarization. M1 is inflammatory, M2 is anti-inflammatory. And normally when they're healthy with their legs moving around, there's a balance between M1 and M2. When trauma hits the brain, the shearing and injury of the neurons release these chemical mediators that these glial cells then churn to these primed glial cells, and they are only in an M1 inflammatory state. And they're just sitting there, and they're just they don't move. And from this point on, that brain is now very susceptible to inflammation. So let me give you an example. Let's say you played some sports or something happened, got in a car accident, and you injured your frontal lobe. Okay? So now these glial cells are primed versus someone, let's say, who falls back and injures their cerebellum, different part of the brain, right? So one person has prime glial cells in the frontal lobe, one person has prime glial cells in the cerebellum. Frontal lobe is involved with focus, attention, concentration. So what could happen is if you have something trigger your inflammatory response, maybe it's air pollution, maybe it's breathing in mycotoxins, maybe it's your insulin surge, maybe it's your gut microbiome, who knows, right? Something triggers your systemic inflammatory response. These prime glial cells that are there from the injury are so reactive to inflammation that they're going to activate right away. So they're very, very sensitive to inflammation. And if they activate in that frontal lobe where the injury is, then the person's focus, attention, concentration will shut down. But for the person who had a brain injury in their cerebellum, they may get dizziness and vertigo and feel unstable. So once these glial cells get primed in a certain area, because it's not the whole brain, it's just certain areas of the brain, let's say for traumatic brain injury as an example, anything inflammatory will bring these things on. So one of the things we look for to see if a patient has primed glial cells is an unproportional response of reactions to inflammation that happen in the brain. So if someone says, hey, you know, when I eat gluten, I get bloated and swelling and my body doesn't feel good. Whereas someone says, I eat gluten, I'm depressed for 3 days. That's different. I eat gluten and I get vertigo, right? So depending on where the prime glial cells are, the glial cells could be in their temporal lobe. They go with the auditory cortex. They eat gluten, that triggers their inflammation, and now they get tinnitus. So these disproportional responses to inflammation gives us clues that there's prime glial cells. And usually when we look back, then the most common cause of these is a past brain injury. And then specific to the region of the brain. So it's very,
like a
very
physical common injury. Just so everybody's clear, we're talking about a traumatic brain injury, a physical injury that could be a car accident or hitting your head on the counter really hard or in the bathroom or, you know, sports injury, something like that.
Yeah. Yes. And the interesting thing is about brain is we've understood head injuries wrong to begin with. We've always thought as head injuries, like you get a head injury and you go, hey, are you okay? Well, I'm dizzy. Well, give it a couple of days. Okay. You're no longer dizzy. You're cured. That's not what happens. What happens is you get a brain injury. These glial cells get turned on and it's like a forest fire. Over the next few years, they recruit other ones and other glial cells. And that inflammation gets more inflammatory and they perpetuate their own vicious cycle. And that same injury is totally different 10 years from the date of injury. And this is why some people don't make the connection. They just, I had an injury, but I thought it was fine. I went to see my doctor, I looked at my pupils, they said I'm fine, you know? And it's like, no. What we're learning about this, and this is in the field of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, is that these things really linger on. And people that get prime glial cells, then they get disproportional brain symptoms anytime they have systemic inflammation. So that's the key. That's the key distinguishing factor. Once these prime glial cells are there, they're there. unless you get rid of him through autophagy, which is where intermittent fasting and those things come in.
Let's talk about that for a minute. How could intermittent fasting and some form of fasting be a process that could get rid of these prime glia cells?
Right. And you have to understand, we're making references from animal studies to humans, but we can't do a human study and put them on a diet and then cut their brain up and look at slices. And so, you know, but they're close enough where we can make some good inferences. So what we know happens is that when people get into an intermittent fasting state, they turn on different gene expression cells, mTOR and other pathways that allow these glial cells to have the healthy ones dissolve, chew up the dead ones, and the prime ones, and get rid of them. It also happens with debris in the brain. So that's really the main, like, there's no nutraceutical that gets rid of prime glial cells. There's nutraceuticals that can dampen inflammation in the brain, like fish oils and turmeric and resveratrol. A lot of the green tea can dampen inflammation in the brain. But to actually change the actual glial cells and to actually get rid of debris in the brain, to turn on the cell messengers for what's called autophagy, this clearing the debris pathway, intermittent fasting is one of the few things that has been ever shown to do it.
to connect it earlier to what you were talking about is that maybe there are some people that can't jump right away into intermittent fasting, but if you clean your diet up a little bit let me take a step back. Is there a way to know if somebody has a bunch of those prime glial cells that is more than just seeing what I interpret to be an overreaction? So like you said, somebody has gluten and okay, yeah, you might not feel as good. And people know that gluten may gum up their digestive system or it might make them feel like sort of like a little bit brain fog. That happens to me, right? Except for when I eat gluten in like Europe, it takes a lot more of that type of gluten. Like there's a place over here, it's called Eataly, and they have it in Boston and New York, and they only make pasta and pizza from flour from Italy, right? They're importing everything in. It's not glyphosate. It's all glyphosate free and other things like that. It's not something that we have on a regular basis, but every so often we might go like once a quarter or whatever. And I don't have that much of a reaction. And actually it's really interesting to see because I wear a continuous glucose monitor. It doesn't spike my glucose either, which is also interesting too. Now I've eaten a lot of it. Okay, great. I don't feel good. And a lot of the symptoms and other things that I've had before with gluten come, but it comes back. But you're saying that if somebody eats gluten or has another sort of impact, a milder sort of head injury or something that would normally throw them off, if they have a disproportionate response, that's the perfect example that they have these prime glial cells. There's no test right now that we can run to see the amount of glial cells and that are prime glial cells in the body, right?
There are tests, but they're only limited to research university settings. They're not commercially available. So they do PET scans and they inject them with a chemical that glial cells take up. And then with the PET, they can measure that chemical that has a dye on it. And they can see how active the glial cells are. So they do have advanced PET scans to look at glial activity. And there's disproportional neuroinflammation with people that have glial cells and even in areas where their brain's injured. But you can't like go to your local radiology center and where you get your x-rays and ask for a PET neuroglia scan because like it's not commercially marketable and it'd be very, very, very expensive to do. I'm sure insurance companies won't cover it. So in a research setting, yes, they can analyze these with imaging. They certainly in animal studies can cut up the brain and look at dyes and see these glial structures change from priming. But we're not, you know, in a real practice setting, real life setting, our only clue that's happening is these disproportional responses to any inflammation. It doesn't have to be gluten. It could be anything that's inflammatory for them. But gluten is a good example because for many people, that is an inflammatory protein trigger.
I'm sure we could do a whole interview on this alone, but just asking for people here, because I don't want to leave them hanging because it's such a fascinating topic. Do you dive into this in your course a little bit more on the topic of prime glial cells, or are there resources out there that if somebody wanted to go down that pathway, they can dig into it a little bit?
For healthcare professionals, we have an institute called the Karazian Institute, and I have a 2-day course all on just neuroglial cells. It's called Neuroinflammation, and it takes 2 days of going through all the literature to explain the details of this. Right, so we're very simplifying it for the podcast, but if you're a clinician and researcher, you want the dump, check out Neuroinflammation course at the Karazian Institute. For people that are not doctors, healthcare professionals, researchers that want some general information, We did create a book called Save Your Brain. It's an online program at drknews.com. And it just goes you through strategies you can simply do through your lifestyle step by step to just reduce inflammation in your brain and improve your overall brain health.
Great. And we'll have the links to those. I wanted to shift topics, but again, I don't want to leave the audience hanging. So I wanted to make sure we got that link over to them for those who wanted to go a little bit deeper. So I want to shift a little bit because, you know, we've talked about gluten, for example, and, you know, you've said before that gluten can be one of the most inflammatory foods for the brain. And just for those that are not familiar, you know, do you still believe that's true? And why is that true, if it is?
Yeah. So I do believe it's true. And I should say, we published a paper 5 years ago, 2014, 15, 16, I don't know, something around it. They're all kind of mixed together now. But we did publish the paper in Nutrients, and we took 400 healthy blood donors. And we wanted to see how many of them had antibodies to gluten and to milk protein, casein. And when you look at gluten, gluten is a protein, but this protein has many branches. There's this alpha gliadin, there's gamma gliadin, there's gluteomorphin, right? There's a glutenin, there's all different branches of gluten. So we tested them from all of them. When people get a blood test and measure gluten, they're only measuring alpha gliadin. So we wanted to measure all the different proteins of gluten. Same with milk. There's alpha casein, beta casein, milk butyrophilin. There's different proteins. So we took 400 people, healthy blood donors, no disease, no symptoms, nothing, and checked to see how many of them had antibodies to milk and wheat, right? So we found it was around 17% had a clearly high antibody immune response to them in a healthy population. I'm not talking about a patient with population with depression or brain fog or neurodegenerative disease, but a healthy population, right? No symptoms whatsoever. So it was about 15-17%, depending on the protein, whether it was milk or gluten. And that was interesting. Okay, so that's more than we thought. And then we then checked antibodies to the brain for all those people, all 400 people. Having antibodies to what's called myelin-basic protein, myelooligodendrocytes, and we want to see, you know, what degree of neurological, not only brain, not just neurological inflammation, but neurological autoimmunity these people had. So the correlation, you know, there's when you look at correlations, something called the R value, and like a one would be a perfect correlation, 1-to-1. If you have this, you have that. And we're getting R values of like 0.7, 0.8. Between gluten and neuroinflammatory markers, neurological autoimmune markers. And we published that paper showing, like, even with people that are healthy, this is pretty prevalent. This is like brewing an underlying neurological disease. So I think it's very prevalent. I think a lot of people don't even know they have it, right? Some people also consume those food proteins on a regular basis and they don't realize what their brain potential is, because all they know is what their brain is doing for them at that given time, right? So some people will go off inflammatory foods and all of a sudden they go, oh my gosh, my brain endurance is different. I feel energized again. I feel like I can focus again. This is incredible. And that may take 2 or 3 weeks to happen. It's just not going to happen with one day of doing it, right? Because you got to get rid of the inflammation and the immune response for that. So I think it's much, much more prevalent than people think. Why does it happen? Well, one of the reasons it happens is because of molecular mimicry. The antibodies made against gliadin and gluten, and even against the lectin portion of wheat germ or glutenin, or so the antibodies produced against those can bind to actual neurons. So when proteins share very similar amino acid sequences, it's called amino acid homology, then when you eat those foods, your immune system will create antibodies against them, but those antibodies can also attach to your own tissues that have similar proteins. And both casein and gluten have been shown to have molecular similarity to brain tissue. So there's a high degree of neuroinflammation that can be promoted just from that.
It's fascinating when you dive deeper into that world of molecular mimicry and just how this one food, you know, wheat, right? And which has a lot of, is probably the primary area that people have their exposure to gluten, this protein, can have all these different ramifications inside of the body. It seems to be, and I'd love to get your thoughts, the wheat here in the United States, which is more genetically modified, it's also genetically modified to have higher amounts of lectins inside of it. And I know you've talked about lectins as being something that, especially autoimmunity patients, in addition to gluten, they need to be maybe a little bit more mindful of, you know, certain lectins and consuming them inside of the body.
Yeah, and remember, the food in the U.S. is hybridized, not necessarily genetically modified, right? The wheat here is, they change the proteins over and over again to make sure that bugs don't eat them, but their DNA has been hasn't technically been changed. It's been there's a hybridization process, but there's certainly different proteins. And there's some studies that have been done, and they found like 5% new protein. They call it modern wheat. Some of the literature on in the gastroenterology disease world and celiac world uses the actual term native wheat and modern wheat because the proteins are not the same. And we tend to have modern wheat more in the US, and Europe still uses more native wheat. And then there's also the process of glyphosates and other pesticides and chemicals that can be changing the protein. So there's an immunological phenomenon called haptenation. What haptenation means is a chemical binds to the protein and the protein structure changes. So just like when you lick a lollipop and your tongue turns red or blue or whatever, that's the food coloring attaching to the protein of your tongue, and now your tongue is a different color, right? That's the protein attachment. So pesticides don't all get washed off. Pesticides bind to the protein and they change the structure of the protein, and they can become more immune reactive. And when that happens, that's called haptenation. So one of the theories of why, you know, people are having such a severe reaction to gluten and a different reaction between gluten in the US versus Europe is because of the chemicals and pesticides that they're using, like glyphosates, that can then change the structure of the protein. So I think there's a lot of that happening.
It's fascinating. Have you noticed that on a personal level yourself? And also the bigger question is, how do you manage, your foods, and do you ever eat gluten over here? You know, you're a human being, so people always want to know, what does the doctor do?
So I don't touch gluten in the US. Actually, if I eat gluten here in the US, I will definitely get a headache. And I don't have celiac disease. I've extensively tested myself for all these markers and all these things. So I just notice when I eat it, I just don't function well. My brain function goes down. And to me, that's counterproductive to everything I'm doing in my life, which is those things. So it's not worth it for me, right? However, if I go to France or somewhere they use glyphosates, I notice I don't have any reactions.
Where they don't use glyphosates.
They don't use glyphosates, right? And like areas in France, still glyphosates are legal, but no one really uses them, you know? And if you don't eat processed foods there, you're not getting much exposure. In areas like Tokyo, Japan, you know, those areas, they don't use any, they're banned completely. You can't use them. I noticed, so if I eat gluten here personally, I'll get a headache and brain swelling. My brain function goes down. I'm like, that's terrible. If I get exposed in Japan or in Europe, I don't have any reaction. So I've personally seen it happen, you know. And then there was a paper that was published. It was published by Dr. Vajdani, Arista Vajdani, where he actually measured T cell responses with people being exposed to modern wheat and native wheat, and she clearly showed there was a big difference. And so wow. These things are pretty interesting.
It's worth trying, and the best thing is people can try it at home. They can go on a process. Like if somebody was going to do and remove gluten, would you recommend a full elimination diet where they're removing, you know, anybody can Google elimination diet and sort of see, and IFM has a bunch of them out there. Dr. Hyman, I'm sure you have some too. Do you recommend a full elimination diet for like the standard 3-week or 21-day period? Or do you think it's enough that they can just remove gluten out of their diet and still keep dairy and other things if they wanted to see how they responded?
Well, for sure. I mean, okay, so there's different theories, and obviously there's a lot of variability within the population for different things. But if you're just going to be generalizable to the whole population for most people, you need to get off milk and dairy. I mean, gluten and dairy. The protein structure of milk protein and gluten are so similar that they cross-react. And this has actually been published in several manuscripts in the celiac disease journals where they have celiac disease patients go on a gluten-free diet, have minimal outcomes. As soon as they go also dairy-free, they have profound improvements. So just like we're talking about molecular mimicry, the antibody, the amino acid sequence of gluten and milk protein casein are so similar that you have to go off both. And this is also like where in the autism world, they know they can't get gluten-free. They have to go gluten dairy-free to make some change, right? And then when it gets into autoimmunity, so I think gluten dairy-free have to kind of go together, unfortunately. And then you can have almond milk and nut milks and coconut milk and things like that. But actual animal milk can be a problem. And then there was a paper I remember I reviewed and helped do data analysis for, but it was, they looked at cow's milk, goat's milk, cumin milk, almond milk, soy milk, and they measured reactivity with it. And the least reactive one is obviously human milk because people don't react to milk proteins. But cow's milk was off the chart. Goat's milk was off the chart. Then the things like almond milk, cashew milk, very little immune reactions for most people. So people that go gluten-free can, you know, switch to cashew butter, cashew milk or almond milk, as long as they don't have reactions to nuts. And then if people have autoimmune disease, they really have to almost go grain-free. They really, we find that it's easier for them, instead of just going gluten-free, just go on a grain-free diet, grain-free, dairy-free diet. And then some people with autoimmunity then also have to avoid lectin. So it really depends on the severity of the disease and the circumstances. But I can tell you from a patient perspective, a lot of times being gluten-free, just going off all grains is much easier than just going gluten-free, because they have to find all the things that or have gluten in them. Just to remember, going off all grains is much simpler sometimes, more effective.
You mentioned autoimmunity, and I think here in the last leg of the interview, I want to just touch on it a little bit, because there is a lot known and there's still a lot that's unknown. And I think there's a lot of patients that are out there that are suffering, that are trying to figure out what is the right approach for them. Let's start off by making the link. You know, you're talking about molecular mimicry and how it can drive neuroinflammation. So off that same idea of molecular mimicry, how does that connect to autoimmune?
So autoimmunity, basically meaning your immune system is attacking itself, right? And normally your immune system should only attack pathogens like bacteria and viruses. But at some point, something happened where your immune system decided that your own tissue was foreign and it started to attack it. And by attack it, it means your immune system is making antibodies, these proteins that then attach to your tissue, and then immune cells like T cells come in and destroy. So that's the main thing that happens in autoimmunity. Now, molecular mimicry is part of the process, but really autoimmunity in the immunology literature is linked to something called loss of immune tolerance. And immune tolerance is this mechanism, this phenomenon of the immune system to distinguish self from non-self. And when a person loses tolerance, which is the term they use in immunology, there's different degrees of tolerance. This autoimmunity is a loss of self-tolerance. So your body can't distinguish self from non-self, it attacks itself. And then self-tolerance usually coincides with what's called loss of dietary protein tolerance, which means you develop food sensitivities, which then also coincides with what's called loss of chemical tolerance. So when people lose tolerance, they start to develop food sensitivities, chemical sensitivities, as they develop their autoimmunity. And then now that they're reacting to foods and chemicals, those things drive their autoimmunity and they get stuck in this vicious cycle. So that's the mechanism, classical mechanism. If you're a researcher and you go, I'm just going to study what's the underlying mechanism of autoimmunity in the current, you know, contemporary literature right now, would be linked to all the studies showing loss of immune tolerance. And then lots of things lead to loss of immune tolerance, like intestinal permeability, leaky gut, dysfunctional Treg cells, dysfunctional Breg cells, abnormal dendritic cells, abnormal Kupffer cells, combination of these things all interacting with each other. So it's a complex mixture of all these things, and that's what causes autoimmunity. And the rates are pretty high. I mean, lots of people that have chronic weird diseases no one can figure out usually have an underlying autoimmune response with them.
What's the link in the context of today where we're hearing a lot about autoimmunity and maybe how viruses can play a part in it? You know, how, just describe the landscape for us.
There's four different mechanisms where pathogens have been shown to turn on autoimmunity. One of them being molecular mimicry. Then one's called bystander activation. One's called cryptic antigen responses. One's called superantigens. And they all have detailed immune mechanisms, which, you know, I don't think your listeners would really want to get into, but there are definitely mechanisms where pathogens can trigger autoimmunity. And we just published a paper, Dr. Vijdani, myself, Dr. Elroy Vijdani, we published it in a journal called Frontiers Immunology, which is one of the, I think it's ranked number four right now of top immunology journals, where we mapped out SARS-CoV-2 amino acid sequences with a spike protein, nuclear protein, membrane protein, and saw which of it cross-react with human tissues. And we checked for 54 human tissues. So we found like SARS-CoV-2 can cross-react with brain tissue. It can cross-react with the cardiovascular tissue, multiple tissues that we were able to find. And we did the study because we figured some of these people that are getting long COVID may have their infection turn on autoimmunity. And we wanted to know like which autoimmune target proteins would be most likely involved. And we also know that a lot of people that get the virus, it can't be accounted for with like the virus binding to what are called ACE receptors alone. That has to be something more than that. So that was why we did the study. And I think some people that, for some people, we don't know what the variables are that make them react to molecular mimicry. But for some people, they'll get a viral infection, and it could be SARS-CoV-2 COVID, or it could be hepatitis C. And then their immune response against those pathogens can absolutely turn on autoimmunity. So that's well known in the literature and the world of immunology. It's kind of scary.
What does that mean for the it's scary, and definitely I think a lot of people are sort of following along, and they're also wondering, so what does this mean for me, especially, you know, if I'm somebody that's already dealing with autoimmune stuff, or I don't want to develop autoimmune, you know, down the line? Is this just another reminder to double down on all the things that we talked about in the beginning part of the podcast, which highly influence our immune system, like our diet, our glucose, getting insulin under control, sleep? What is the takeaway around that?
Well, I think the takeaway is, like, you know, it depends on, like, who you ask and which group you ask. If you ask just the research community, they say, we don't have any data that can actually show these lifestyle changes are going to stop you from having autoimmune from infection. We don't have a randomized clinical trial. And I don't even know from a research perspective how you would design a study to really look at these. It's not even feasible, to be quite honest, to do. So there'll be a person, percentage of the community, that says those things don't really have any evidence. And then there's, like, well, sometimes you got to use logic, you know, like, there's things that turn on immune tolerance, and that's what you want to do. And maybe you should get sleep, and maybe you should calm down your neuroglial cells, and maybe you should improve your barriers, because these things all have associations that all connect together and have an impact. So, you know, this is the funny thing about healthcare. You have the people that don't really understand research themselves and think that you can create a research model for everything you think of, and it's impossible to create a research methodology for every question you have. It just, lots of things are infeasible and you can't develop a study design for it. This would be one of them. That'd be very hard to do. So then they'll be like, well, there's no evidence in this, so it's all discounted, it's all quackery. And it's like, no, you're an idiot and you don't understand research. That's the problem. Okay. And then there's sometimes we are limited with using associations and logic in a real clinical setting to make it best determination, right? And in that setting, it's, yeah, getting proper sleep will have an impact on your immune system that probably will be favorable from you to having your autoimmune disease express if you get an infection. Having your vitamin D levels restored and improving your Treg function will probably have some degree of impact. And, you know, years ago, there was a survey done with functional medicine practitioners, and they were asking conventional medical physicians that got into the world of functional medicine, what drove you to get into functional medicine? And you know what the answer was?
No, tell me.
It was they got sick, or a family member got sick.
I can believe that.
Right. And there's like, well, I don't have a double blinded clinical trial for this research question, but I got to put these things together because I have like MS and I don't know what to do. Maybe I should take vitamin D, which is interesting because they may not have suggested that to their patient, but now they're sick. Now they're starting to look at logic and associations. And that is really the real practice of medicine and healthcare, right? That you use the best evidence-based medicine is you use the best information you have that has the least amount of risk based on personal philosophy and make the appropriate choice. It's not just based on a complete several meta-analyses with multiple double-blind clinical trials that are randomized to show one effect. So that's the disconnect I think we have. But theoretically, to answer your question, yes, you should get sleep, you should get vitamin D, you should exercise, you should do all those things, because more than likely that will stop, will have a great probability of improving your health if you get an infection and not developing autoimmunity, because those things all have an impact on immune tolerance.
And for the small but growing body of people that find themselves in this sort of, you know, long COVID, which is, you know, a hotly debated, yep, and talked about area, what are the key resources that you've been finding or recommending to patients that are in that category that are looking for answers?
So I got to be honest with you. I'm not convinced with anything yet. I don't know. I mean, I think some of these people have autoimmunity. I think for anyone to make claims is too premature. And I think even alternative medicine, not. But you can always bet there's some fundamental things the human body needs. The human body needs movement. The human body needs nutrition. The human body needs sleep. The human body needs interaction, right? So those things all, no matter what disease you're studying, if you're studying cardiovascular disease or neurological disease, or if you can get better sleep and get exercise and get movement and have high nutrients and antioxidants in your system, it's going to probably have some beneficial effect, right? So I don't know. I'm still waiting to see more and more research on long COVID. I think part of it is just immune dysregulation, immune dysfunction. I think some of it is cross-reactivity, molecular mimicry. I think it's going to be a multivariate approach for different people. What we really need to see is what's happening with long COVID, which we haven't seen yet. We do got to see like which cells are failing. Is it T-reg cells failing? Is it B-reg cells failing? Is it dendritic cells failing? Is it an overactive cytokine response? Is it a certain messenger pathway? Is it the viral genome combining with a certain human genome that is really the factor? It has nothing to do with the person's immune status to begin with. It's just genes plus the pathogen, genes connecting together. Those are all the real questions. I don't know. So now certainly if I had long COVID or had family member or loved one did, I'm going to probably boost my immune system up and get sleep and take nutraceuticals to impact my T cells. And it will be trial and error. And sometimes when you don't know, you can do trial and error with things that are not unsafe, like exercise, sleep, antioxidants, nutrients.
And dietary safety. Interventions. Is yeah. there a protocol that's out there that, you know, something that's easy that people could get? Or do you have a protocol or a book out there that people could kind of like follow to just hit the basics?
Well, yes and no. Like we don't say anything listed to COVID, long COVID, because I don't know enough about it. I can't feel comfortable recommending.
Not so much about long COVID, but just like a protocol that they could follow that whether they were autoimmune or something else, that could begin to help them down that pathway.
We made a bunch of free videos, Dr. K News, and how to improve your immune resilience that people can access if they go to our website, Dr. K News, and it talks about things to do to improve resilience, but it's not specific for, let's say, long COVID or infection or anything. As a way to help the community.
One of the videos that you made that I really like that we want to link to over here, and I'd love to have you back here on just to talk about this, is you have 10 reasons why people who have autoimmune don't get better. And I thought that was a very fascinating video that you made on there, because there's a lot of things inside of there that people don't think about or may have not been told about from their practitioners. So if anybody's interested, they can watch that inside the link in the show notes, and maybe we'll get a chance to have you back on to just talk about the autoimmunity side, because there's a lot that's there.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Putting it all together, you know, we hit these top categories for anybody that is worried about their brain being on fire, for anybody that is paying attention to this category of, wow, you know what? I think I do have some neuroinflammation and I want to take some steps that are there. Give us just a final recap of things that we can do today that start us down the pathway of beginning to cool out that fire and not only improve our brain health, because a lot of things that we do for our brain end up improving our gut health, improving our heart health. That, you know, makes a difference in all of our body. But let's just do a little bit of a recap as a summary for those folks that are still with us in the interview.
Okay, sure. So the summary is this. First of all, if you have brain inflammation, your earliest symptom is you're going to have brain fog and you're going to have less brain endurance. And less brain endurance would probably be for cognitive tasks like reading, driving, your work, whatever you may be doing. And then if it progresses from there, neuroinflammation can then lead to like chronic fatigue patterns and depression. And then if it goes from there, then it can lead to neurodegenerative disease. So it just goes through that transition. And if you do have brain fog and fatigue you've noticed that your brain endurance is compromised, then you may want to look at some strategies to lower your brain inflammation. We talked about a couple of big ones we spent some time on. One of them was just air quality, air pollution. So just improving the air quality of your house, that would be a good idea to do. Getting circulation, getting a HIPAA filter, trying to get rid of old carpet, making sure your vents are clean. Those are all very simple strategies. And that may really make a big difference in your endurance at your home and especially in your office if you're working right away. And that's also most likely dampening neuroinflammation too, because those small particulate pollutants can definitely trigger neuroinflammation. It's been shown in numerous studies at this point. Another one was you got to make sure that you have no changes in your energy after you eat. Well, if your blood sugar drops or if you have a big insulin surge after you eat or you get tired after you eat or you feel energized and like can function again, those are signs that you don't have blood sugar stability. So getting your blood sugar stable. So when you eat, the only thing you notice is you're just not hungry anymore. Not that you're functioning again or now you need to have a coffee to function. Those would have a huge impact on getting your brain function down. And the other key thing is just when you're looking at neuroinflammation, exercise and movement help these glial cells. Sleeping activates these glial cells to help get rid of debris and be more efficient. And then there's a list of flavonoids that have been published that have been shown to impact glial cells. The ones with the most evidence would be things like turmeric, resveratrol, and green tea extract. Those are the top most published three flavonoids that have an
anti-inflammatory. Would you put quercetin in there as well? That's been getting a lot of attention. Would you put that up in that category?
Quercetin is in the literature as well, but the ones with the most amount of evidence are those three.
Perfect. Sorry to interrupt you.
No problem. So those are the simple things you do. Take some turmeric, curcumin, green tea, get some sleep, get some exercise, get your blood sugar stable, improve the air quality, and then see your brain turn on. And that's a good place to start.
Well, your brain is definitely turned on because you summarized that in a fantastic way. And Dr. Datis Karazian, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast and talking about this thing that is so ubiquitous that a lot of people do not know that it's there. And yet we're spending billions, soon to be trillions, if you look at the direction that our healthcare spend is going as a percentage of GDP. It's out of control. And one of those most expensive diseases to manage are these neurological diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, et cetera. So this is a topic that everybody's excited about. And I saw a survey that said the scariest diseases to people are those neurodegenerative diseases, these neuroinflammation diseases, because the scariest thing in the world is to, you know, cancer is also scary too, but at least you know who you are through the process. These neuroinflammation at the biggest level, right? We're talking about early on, it can be brain fog, you know, other conditions that you mentioned, maybe headaches, things like that. But at their highest level, you basically are losing your mind and you don't know who you are. And that's a very scary thing. And my heart goes out to anybody that's out there that is a caretaker or is going through that themselves. I went through that with my grandfather who had a cognitive decline and dementia. And so people are looking for hope. And what you did on the podcast today and with your work is you're providing hope to folks. And I just want to acknowledge you and thank you for your work in that category.
Well said, Drew. Thank you so much. You did a great summary too. Your brain's on too.
Let's keep it going that way. Dr. Karazian, thank you again for joining. And we look forward to having you again in the future.
Pleasure. Anytime.